Good afternoon. Welcome to the LaRouche Show for Saturday, August 30th, 2014. This is Michelle Steinberg from Executive Intelligence Review. I'm the guest host today, and I'm very, very happy to welcome colleague Dean Andromedis, who will be with us today talking about the new Suez project for Egypt and the Middle East and a new possible renaissance for the Middle East because of the orientation that Egypt's new president is taking towards China, Russia, the BRICS countries, and a new world economic order. So I'd like to say hello to Dean and then go into a couple of news updates about Lyndon LaRouche and Helga LaRouche's world intervention. Dean, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, welcome. We're glad to have you. So first of all, listeners, readers and followers of Executive Intelligence Review, this has been a really incredible and indicative week for knowing what Lyndon LaRouche and Mrs. Helga Zepp LaRouche are up to. And it really illustrates the impact, the global impact that LaRouche's ideas have each and every day. You don't always see it because of things like the corruption of the Western media, but believe me, it is the case that the leadership of leading nations who want to avoid the threat of thermonuclear war and leading people in the United States look to Lyndon LaRouche and his movement for the leadership and the answers. This has been going on for decades, and it is coming to a head now. So just this week, I want to highlight two things that Lyndon and Helga LaRouche have been in the middle of. On August 20th, Mr. LaRouche was interviewed by the very, very well listened to and widespread voice of Russia, one of their radio shows. And from the transcript, they begin, they say, first of all, Dr. LaRouche, thank you so much for finding the time to talk to us. And I suggest we take a closer look at U.S. foreign policy. And the general understanding is that President Obama has failed. How accurate is this assessment? Mr. LaRouche says, Obama is a complete failure. There's no question about that. But the failures can come in various forms. But what's important about what Lyndon LaRouche develops in the Voice of Russia interview is that he poses the alternative that is on the table now. It is unfolding right now. And he says, we've got nations, India, Russia, China, the nations of the BRICS states, which, just to remind people, includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. LaRouche says these are all nations which are ready to gather together and to begin to solve these problems. And I, on my part, to do my part to try to keep this thing alive and working. There has to be, LaRouche says, a new world order based not on what most people think would be a new world order, but countries trying to come together, trying to be independent of this nonsense that goes on. Look at India, India's independence, this is tremendous. China's achievement is enormous. We haven't even begun to see how important China is in terms of helium-3, for example, its development. So, therefore, we are on the edge of the greatest triumph for mankind ever. We just have to make it happen. Then, obvious for you, if you've been following the LaRouche show for the last several weeks, the mention of helium-3 is the gateway to the future of fusion energy power and the kind of power that we need for the next centuries, not the next days, months, or years, centuries. Now, this is not academic. What China is doing today is pursuing a policy that LaRouche movement, and especially Mrs. Helga Zepp LaRouche, have had input into for decades. In 1996, Helga Zepp LaRouche oversaw the production of the Landbridge Report. She participated in a major conference that is also known as the New Silk Road. As of this past week, according to Chinese press accounts, Helga Zepp LaRouche is back in China. Mrs. LaRouche is head of the Schiller Institute. She founded the Schiller Institute 30 years ago, and she is participating in a conference on the New Silk Road held August 25th and 26th at Lanzhou University in a northwest section of China. 100 officials and experts from 21 countries are participating under the title One Belt and One Road. And Helga Zepp LaRouche spoke during the Cultural Exchange Forum on the topic, The Silk Road in the 21st Century is the Cornerstone of Peace and Order. We will be hearing much, much more about Helga Zepp LaRouche's visit to China and the New Silk Road, which, as she says, is the answer to peace and is a cornerstone of peace, the answer to the war, the hell of war that is going on right now in Syria, in Iraq, and in Ukraine. The last thing I want to report news-wise is a very brief item. American listeners, especially, much more than listeners in Europe and in other parts of the world, American listeners have been inundated, flooded with the biggest line of garbage propaganda overseen by Barack Obama and the White House in particular in the last months, but especially the last 48 hours, about a Russian invasion of the Ukraine. Now, we know that the real impetus for this Cold War that threatens to become a thermonuclear war is the United Kingdom, the British Empire, the Queen herself, and the archaic, useless institution known as NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And over the last 48 hours, NATO propaganda has been pumping out so-called satellite photos of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now, those of us at EIR who have worked on this whole question of war propaganda and NATO and British Washington lies, especially in the Iraq War of 2003, remember a lot about satellite photos. They were complete lies and garbage. Satellite photos showed us that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, showed us biological weapon trailers. It had nothing to do with of the kind. Now, we don't have to just look at past history on poking holes in this propaganda, but today, August 29th, or I should say Friday, August 29th, the organization called OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which has been overseeing ceasefire and peace talks, attempted peace talks, between the fascist Ukraine putsch government that was put in there by Britain and the United States early this year, and Russian minority separatist forces, the OSCE put out statements today that there is no evidence backing up what NATO is claiming. The Russian representative to the OSCE made a statement today. He said, We have heard these accusations during the past week and the week before that. All of them were proven false back then and are being proven false again now. That was a Russian representative. We expect him to go after the lies. But more importantly, the statement from the standing representative of Switzerland at the OSCE, Thomas Greminger, also said there is no evidence provided by either the OSCE observer team on site nor by any official agency or government of the involvement of, quote, regular Russian troops, unquote. That is an invasion. So that's a very good step in the direction of ending the insanity of this propaganda. So I want to turn right now to the concretes of an economic policy, a new possible new economic world order, a new cornerstone of peace and order that Egypt is in the middle of. And Dean has been writing on this for the last several weeks since President al-Sisi of Egypt made the spectacular announcement in early August about a new Suez Canal. So, Dean, please go ahead and explain the Suez Canal project historically and today.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle. Well, on August 5th, President al-Sisi took the world by surprise at a ceremony, an opening ceremony launching the beginning of a project that would double the size of the Suez Canal within 1 year. Now, and this came, what's very interesting about this and what's very beautiful about this, that it came within a month of the meeting of the BRICS in Brazil, which we, of course, have been reporting on extensively, and marks a total phase change in current world history. So what does this mean? Now the Suez Canal, if you look at a map, this is probably, along with the Panama Canal, it is one of the two most important transocean waterways on the planet. Already, this canal, located at the point where the huge continent of Africa touches the Eurasian landmass, between the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, and Israel, where a very bitter conflict has just ended. And if you look at a map, you will see that this is the path between China and Asia and the Atlantic world. And give you an idea of what this means logistically. Now, the Panama Canal links the Pacific and the Atlantic. The Suez Canal links the Indian Ocean, also the Pacific, the Indian Ocean, the Mediterranean, through the Mediterranean, the Atlantic. 8-10% of the world's trade passes through this canal. The canal is capable of accommodating the largest ships in the world, the largest container ships in the world. To give you an example, the largest container ship in the world, the so-called Triple E class, carries 18,000 containers. Now, if you put those containers on a train, the train would be 100 kilometers long, about 60 miles.
Wow.
And that one ship carries at least $500 million worth of wares that it is transporting from Asia to Europe and the United States. Now, this canal can accommodate those ships, but the only problem is it is a one-way canal. That is to say that the ships are gathered in convoys on either side of the canal and have to wait till one convoy coming from the north passes and then the convoy coming from the south passes. And that takes time. And the way the shipping industry works now, it works on a tight, particularly container ships. They work on the schedule as tight as airlines, because everything, almost everything that every commodity that you can think about now travels through ships from container ships, from flowers and food to machinery and computers and laptops, electronics, but even more clothing, even more important commodities that you don't normally think about. So it is very, very important. And the decision itself, in a sense, was courageous, because if Egypt was to ask the World Bank or the IMF, you know, we want to double the size of the canal, they would come up and say, well, listen, you know, the world trade is stagnating, shipping rates are very low, you know, why do you want to invest all this money, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the way they're thinking. Egypt has joined the BRICS. The BRICS are going, they're committed to an economic development policy that's going to expand world trade, not through bringing commodities to the dying economies of Western Europe and the United States and Canada. They are going to be expanding the economy through cooperation among themselves. So Al-Sisi and the people who he is talking with, of course, are the BRICS. Brazil, he will be visiting Brazil next autumn. Russia, he visited Russia just a few weeks ago. He will be making a visit to China. The Chinese president sent his foreign minister just before this August 5th ceremony, delivering a message from the Chinese president inviting Egypt to join the Maritime Silk Road and Economic Belt. And that's the key to this, is if you look at the map, the Chinese president in October was in Southeast Asia touring the countries there, met with the so-called ASEAN countries, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and announced the development of what he called the Maritime Silk Road, as compared to the Land Bridge Silk Road connecting the overland routes between China, Central Asia, Russia, and Europe. And the Silk Road Economic Belt, which links both of those routes, the Maritime Silk Road and the Land Bridge Silk Road, into a belt of development. And this belt of development is going to unleash an economic process that this planet has not experienced in its history. And this is the basis of the decision that the Egyptians took to take on this project. So what has happened is virtually every company that has heavy earth moving equipment has been mobilized to dig this canal. Companies involved in the mining industry, because they have heavy bulldozers and the big trucks to move the dirt, the sand, they've all been mobilized to something like 52 companies, and probably now as many as 15,000 workers are now deployed on this project. So it's very, very exciting. Now, there's another level to this, is the whole economic approach, because what Egypt has gone through, and this is the role that Al-Sisi has been playing. As people remember, there was a mass movement, mass demonstrations, protesting the policies of the Muslim Brotherhood president, Mohammed Morsi, last year. Which entailed demonstrations of 500,000 Egyptians, and they were protesting the fact that al-Morsi was about to bring Egypt directly into the conflict to overthrow the Syrian government, which would have thrown Egypt and it did to a certain extent, into a civil war type situation. And the president, under President al-Sisi's leadership, when he was the leader of the army moved in and removed Morsi from power and tried to stabilize the government, and they're still in this process. Now, many people died in this conflict. It's a very demoralizing and destructive process. And what he has done with this project is, in part, to refocus the energies of the population to look towards the future through participating in this project. And it's very, very interesting. There's a whole mobilization. For instance, the financing of this project. Now, this is not going to be done with World Bank loans or raising capital in the so-called market, international markets. They do not want that, because they do not want this asset, Egypt's most important physical asset, to fall back into the hands of the, as they see it, imperial powers. And this is a very, very historic and sensitive issue in Egypt, if you know the history of this canal. I mean, it was built, as people might know, it was built by the French in the middle of the 18th century. And people don't know this. I mean, normally people think that, oh, the canal was built by the French and the British participated in it. They owned the canal and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's not even half truth. The reality was, yes, they owned the canal, and they were supposedly, the Egyptian government at that time was supposed to have owned half of it. But the reality was that most of the loans that were taken out to build the canal were taken out by the then Egyptian government. And the government could not pay these loans. And the process of not being able to pay these loans forced the government to sell its shares in the canal to the British. And the British leveraged these loans to basically take over Egypt and turn Egypt into a colony. And everyone knows this in Egypt. And this is a very emotional historical experience for them. Now, it wasn't just something in the 19th century. In 1956, President Gama Abdel Nasser, the famous founder of the Egyptian Republic, the post-war republic, actually 1952, he nationalized the canal after he was refused financing by the United States and the Western financial institutions in order to build the famous Aswan High Dam on the Nile, which was the biggest such infrastructure project in history. So his idea was that he would nationalize the canal, which he had a constitutional and legal right to do, with compensation, and use the proceeds from this canal to finance the dam project. Well, the British Empire, which still considered itself an empire despite the fact that everyone knew it was bankrupt, along with the French, said this is impossible, and they went to war. They conspired with Israel at the time and had Israel attack Egypt and use that as an excuse so they could invade Egypt to protect the canal, which was an international waterway. Now, of course, they didn't bother telling President Eisenhower at the time that this was their conspiracy, because they know that he would not agree with that. And of course he didn't, and it was famous that Eisenhower took this to the United Nations and forced the British to withdraw. And he was probably the only post-war, only president of the United States that actually prevented, I forget what exactly he did, but there was a run on the pound, the British pound sterling at the time, and he did nothing to stop it. And Britain was running out of, they were literally running out of foreign exchange. And Eisenhower said, well, I'll let up on you only if you withdraw your troops.
You mean, Dean, President Eisenhower would not bail them out. Is that right?
He would not bail them out.
Yeah, okay.
And he used that to force them not only to withdraw, but Anthony Eden, the prime minister at the time, had to go. And he announced that he was having a nervous breakdown, and he left the government. And the war ended. Everyone knows this history in Egypt. And
right.
So therefore, this canal will never go into foreign hands.
Okay, so let's just pin down that one thing that you said. How are they going to finance it without the international IFIs?
Well, they are going to use a process that echoes what Alexander Hamilton did when he had American citizens subscribe to the national debt. He will be issuing debt certificates, and only Egyptian citizens will be allowed to buy these certificates. Now, they will be denominated in the 10 Egyptian pound notes, so students can buy them, and 100 and 1,000 pound Egyptian pound notes. And you can buy as many as you want. And they will have a 12% interest rate, because in Egypt you have a relatively high rate of inflation. For Egyptians that live overseas, they will have the opportunity to buy these debt certificates denominated in dollars, and these will have an interest rate of 3%. The bonds will have a duration of 5 years, and interest will be paid on them after the first year. Now, this is I don't know if I know of any other country that has done this. I know Ethiopia has done it with their citizens living overseas, where you can buy a bond denominated in euros, a 300 euro bond, to help them finance their big infrastructure projects, the big dam projects they're building. So this is a very unique form of financing, and it was totally accepted and applauded in Egypt, not only among common people who now are preparing to withdraw their money from their investment funds in the banks. The investment funds in the Egyptian banks to invest in these certificates, which have a government guarantee. So this is very, very interesting, and they will probably use this method for other infrastructure projects.
Let me Let me just try and draw a parallel for some of our listeners, and especially some of the older people like me and older. Remember the stories, actually, this was before I was around, but during World War II, the US war bonds, which just every American tried to buy, even though they were just coming out of a depression to help the countries. This is the, I think, the spirit of the population that's involved in Egypt, and to revive that feeling. One of my Egyptian friends recalls when he was in grammar school, the patriotic songs involved the building of the high dam, and how Egyptian families put photographs of President Eisenhower, American President Eisenhower, on their walls of their homes to thank the American president for saving the canal from British and Israeli and French imperial hands. So, I think what you're describing is a real spirit of a country that has gone through, as you said, a very, very painful process of revolutions, assassinations, and so forth. And the only way out of a dark age like that is a kind of renaissance. So I just wanted to throw in that war bonds and analogy, and have people think about the power of that. In that context, Dean, may I ask you to tell us a little bit about some of the things that President al-Sisi has also done in vis-a-vis Ibero-America, because it seemed like almost at the same time he announced the new Suez Canal and wrote a fantastic letter to Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. In support of Argentina's fight against the vulture funds, was that indicative of another process, economic policy going on in Egypt?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, it should be noted, you mentioned Argentina. I just wrote an article today on these projects, and I came to the point on Egypt's plans for a nuclear reactor. And Egypt has two research reactors, an old one built by the Soviet Union. And they have a newer one, a much larger one. It's a research reactor. It's 20 megawatts, and this is built by the Argentine one of the Argentine nuclear reactor company. And it was it only went online, I think, into operation in 1998. So this is a relatively recent development. So, just on the question of Egyptian Argentine relations, they are there. So, and one of the projects that President al-Sisi announced when he became president, which will be going forward, would be their proposal for a nuclear power station on the Mediterranean. So, this is not just a question of Egyptian solidarity, but it's also a very directly linked to the type of economic cooperation we are going to be seeing between Egypt and Argentina and the BRICS and the growing number of countries that are allying with this new emerging alliance. So yes. This is what you said. It is a shift in a real sense in Egypt. I think I'll leave it at that.
Oh, okay. Well, we just have been joined by our colleague Gretchen Small from the EIR Ibero-American section, who will also give us some further information on the Latin American, Russian, China, India side of BRICS. Gretchen, we were just talking about President al-Sisi's letter that he sent to Cristina Fernandez against the vulture funds, and Nadine filled us in about, I didn't know this at all, that Argentina had built the 20-megawatt research reactor, the nuclear reactor, in Egypt, and al-Sisi's commitment to a nuclear energy building program there, which would be just absolutely incredible. A couple of other things. You mentioned the Maritime Silk Road with China, Dean. Let me ask if you could tell us more about the Egypt-Russia relations, because there was a very big meeting on August 12th when President al-Sisi visited Putin. And their visit was described as, I think in the Egyptian media, seeking new horizons for export and investment. So given the sanctions on Russia, is there some potential for Egypt's immediate economy in relations with Russia on this?
Well, I think there's the economic dynamic here, and there's also the political dynamic. Economically, it is clear. At that meeting, they spoke very concretely about expanding food, trade, and agricultural products. Now, the two countries complement one another. Egypt, because of its climate, is a tremendous producer of fruits and vegetables. And Russia, on the other hand, being in the northern zone, in the northerly zone, it is in a sense a real potential, and it always has been, a breadbasket for grain. So what you're going to see is what they have agreed on is to have this exchange. Russia will continue to supply and expand that supply of grains to Egypt, and Egypt will export to Russia its fruits and vegetables. And they even discussed the idea of building a processing zone, a port on the Black Sea. And again, this is gets back to what I said earlier about you know, the need to expand the canal, because there's going to be an increase of trade between among all the countries that are now allying themselves with the BRICS. So this is a perfect big example of that. The other, of course, Russia, the Soviet Union, prior to 1991, had a long history with post-World War II Egypt. The Aswan Dam was actually built with the help of the Soviet Union. And for many years, the Soviet Union was a supplier of arms. As I said earlier, they supplied the first research reactor back in the 60s. And this was in fact referenced by President Putin after the meeting, describing the meeting and the discussion. So I think, in terms of economic cooperation, really the sky's the limit. The other aspect, of course, is political. As people know, President Morsi was a good friend of Barack Obama, and throwing him out of office to save Egypt has not ingratiated President al-Sisi. I don't think he cares. He obviously doesn't care in the eyes of Obama, and Obama has made that clear. But Egypt is facing, you know, the catastrophe that the British Empire and their stooge Obama have created in the Middle East. and rescue the country from what could have been what we are now seeing in Syria. But Russia and China have made it clear in the last month alone that they fully support President Assisi, that Egypt is the main interlocutor for Russia and China in the Middle East, and that is very, very, very important. And we're already seeing changes slowly coming in the region because of that.
There's one other thing directly on this point you just mentioned that I'd like you to talk about. You know, during that horrific 50-some-day Gaza war of war crimes and horrible civilian killings of children and so forth, there was a lot of talk that, ha, 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 Egypt is going to go, they'll never support the Palestinians because Hamas equals the Muslim Brotherhood, and a lot of absolutely useless, untrue, laughable, ridiculous analysis. Nothing like that happened at all. In fact, Egypt played a role in the ceasefire. Could you talk about that?
Well, the point is that the war started to sabotage this conflict 50 days ago, started to sabotage the work that Egypt had done. Prior to this conflict, President Assisi himself brokered a unity agreement between Mohammed Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas in the West Bank and Gaza. And they formed a unity government where the Palestinian Authority would come back to the Gaza Strip, where it was thrown out by Hamas several years ago now, and that the border crossings particularly between Egypt and the Gaza Strip would come under the authority of the Palestinian Authority. This would have placated the Israelis, and we wouldn't have had this conflict. Now, President Obama backed. He was playing all sides. He backed Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who didn't want to come to any peace agreement with the Palestinians at all. And he said, well, we can't recognize Hamas is a terrorist organization, and blah, blah, blah. And of course, the conflict started soon after that. So what you actually saw was a sabotage of a policy hammered out, brokered by President Assisi, because of this conflict, directly by Obama and the British, who were backing Netanyahu, and also the so-called Qatar-Turkey-Sunni alliance, which was also undermining this agreement through influencing Hamas, trying to tell Hamas that they shouldn't go in with this deal. I mean, that's what I think is the actual truth of this, and all this other stuff is nonsense.
Absolutely, absolutely. Listeners, Dean, and myself, your host for today, Michelle Steinberg, we've worked on the Middle East together for a lot of years, and it's absolutely correct. We can't say it enough times. The war on Gaza had nothing to do with all of the things that the American media has been talking about, rocket fire and this and that. It was to break the unity agreement so that there couldn't be any further steps on a peace agreement. And this policy of permanent war, permanent conflict that the British Empire has used for a century or more than a century. So I'm going to ask that Gretchen and Dean focus this last part of the discussion today on the LaRouche show on what Lyndon LaRouche has called the principle of creativity, the Promethean principle. And I was really struck by last week's LaRouche webcast that when, I'm sorry, it was Monday's policy committee webcast when the subject of Egypt was brought up and what Egypt is doing with the new Suez Canal and its orientation to the BRICS, LaRouche immediately started talking about creativity and ended the discussion on the note of the Promethean principle. The Promethean principle of standing up to the gods of Mount Olympus who say, no, human beings cannot have creativity. They must suffer the whims of this Olympian dictatorship. So we're overthrowing that right now. And Gretchen, at the beginning of the show, Dean gave really a beautiful summary of the importance of the two greatest waterways of the world, the transoceanic waterways, the importance on the planet. One is, of course, the Suez Canal, what we talked about, and the other is the link between the Atlantic, the direct link between the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans, now standing in the form of the Panama Canal. And the BRICS, especially China, are deeply involved in a new canal that will transform in the same way that the Suez Project, or maybe even greater, but there will be a transformation in world trade, and that's the Nicaragua Project. So
this is, I was thinking before on in terms of what the BRICS has set off, this process has set off things that I think probably one of the most stunning examples is what Dean was going through on Egypt, right, worldwide, of transforming whole regions. But with the potential now to transform the entire Caribbean Central American region, which is, as a matter of fact, wasn't it the last show what we were discussing, the question on drugs, right, Michelle, when mm-hmm. you and I were on, and we were discussing, this is an area which has largely been taken over by drugs, and we are now set through the construction of the Nicaraguan Canal and what the shift in thinking that comes with it, right, which is what points to what you're saying on the question of creativity. This is really exciting. What you have is work has now begun. In June, they announced the route for the canal across the Central American Peninsula. It's a 173-mile route, which takes advantage of the Lake Nicaragua, which was in the middle of Nicaragua. So it's longer, but 65 of that is through an existing lake. It's going to be bigger, deeper, and wider than the Panama Canal, and therefore can accommodate, you know, the big ships of today. And ground is supposed to break in December on this project. And they began now in August, begin doing the survey work of the people. You know, they're going to have to move some people, and they're going to have to clear the land and get ready to go. But the private Chinese company that is running has the concession from the Nicaraguan government to do this, HKND, has been holding meetings with the Nicaraguan government and others, including the Nicaraguan private sector, including the American Chamber of Commerce, including people from the rest of the region who are meeting with people in the country and saying, here's the plan, here's how it's going to work, what are you worried about? What, you know, in other words, doing the political mobilization required to make such a big project come through work. This has already got almost everybody in Central America desperately interested, because this is 50,000 construction jobs minimally. So they're building two ports, they're building a canal, they're building a free trade zone, which can mean a lot of things. There, you know, you have all that dirt that's going to be in 41 deposits along the canal. It's going to be leveled, and some of that's going to be for farming, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You're building a new lake, which can be used for fishing as well as other things. They're going to have to build a cement and a steel factory because Nicaragua doesn't have the basis for this, and they're desperately running to try to train the people to run it. Everybody's been saying in the press, talk about lies on the Gaza thing. Okay, I've read umpteen articles for the last 3 months on how it's a mysterious little known company, HKND, who is this private investor, whatever. Look, the companies he subcontracted to build the canal, to do the survey work, to build the ports on either end and all this, are the four top Chinese, actually state companies in rail, in road, in civil aviation, and in water development. And the actual canal design is being done by the Qingjiang Institute for Survey, Design, and Planning of China, which did the Three Gorges Dam project and is involved heavily in designing the South Water North project. This is big time. This is real, and it's going to work. And people are, Hondurans have no jobs. What are we talking about, 70, 80% unemployment? They're looking at this. People are looking towards it. A very interesting view of this was published in early August, on the 8th, actually, in Cuba's Juventud Rebelde. It's a daily. They have an international reporter, regular one for them, who did a long article on the Great Nicaraguan Canal called Navigating the Great Nicaraguan Canal, which is it's a beautiful picture because he said, look, it's not a competition to the Panama Canal. When these two canals in the next decade are functional, you're looking at a transformation of the entire Central American Caribbean basin. You've already got all the half dozen megaports are like in Cuba, right? Where the Chinese, for example, have just agreed to help build a multi-purpose terminal in Cuba at Santiago de Cuba, their port there, right? They're all gearing up for what this is going to mean of the two-way traffic between Europe, the Americas, and Asia, back and forth in an economy, world economy that must be growing and will be growing. And he said that, yes, you've got a lot of geopolitical talk in the press. Oh, what are the geopolitical implications? He said the benefits of this project are so big that that's going to eliminate all the friction of this thing. China, he said, is a principal investor. Russia will participate, but the United States is also interesting. Mind you, this is a Cuban publication, right, doing this. Right. I think the three countries, when the time comes, will say, this isn't personal, this is business. The alarmists ought to take this into account. And this is an answer for Mexico, and this is an answer for Cuba, I mean, for Colombia. What you have, I think that sort of demonstrates what the BRICS process set up. I still think that Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner the president of Argentina, gave a most beautiful description of what the BRICS mean in the world when she said, what you have in the world today is a group of countries who are not out to step on our heads and who are willing to collaborate on economic development to pull the great cart of the world economy forward. And that recognition has meant across the globe, Bangladesh wants in on the BRICS. They've told their ambassador to do it. Vietnam, which the Obama administration was trying to use against China, sent a letter to Cristina of Argentina and said, I'm with you. They've now sent a delegation to China trying to cool out the frictions that were developed. The ASEAN nations, the Southeast Asian nations, met with China August 8th through 10th, and the whole anti-China thing fell into a cocked hat. Thailand is shifting, right, orienting towards this different concept of production, of growth, of actually changing the face of the earth. And the Argentines, they launched a prototype satellite launcher on the 15th of August, because they're going to be the first country in the southern hemisphere to have its own satellite launcher to launch for third parties satellites that they're building.
Wow.
And their whole university, they've got a whole university program or arranged around that. Otherwise, what they're doing on the side is kicking out the foreign banks, right? They've raided HSBC. They threw out the Bank of New York. They eliminated their charter, wrote it off.
Was that because of our show about the HSBC, the biggest drug bank in the world has been kicked out. That's good news.
There's a spirit of defiance, but it's not defiance against, it's defiance for the right of nations to educate their people, to give them jobs, to give them skilled jobs. And I think what the Bolivian government is doing, which is Bolivia is one of the poorest governments in all of Central and South America. It's got a population, some of which still live in almost pre-agriculture, right? I mean, it's got a very rough situation. And what are President Evo Morales and his vice president, Alvaro Garcia Linera, are campaigning for president in the upcoming October elections on the basis that Bolivia must seize its right to master and deploy the sacred fire, and now I'm quoting, of the 20th and the 21st century nuclear energy. And they're telling their population, we have the right to do it. As a matter of fact, what Garcia Linera said is, in a speech to a meeting in Bolivia just last week, really, let us break the mental and colonial chains, break them. Let us dare to leave the cave as our ancestors did 20,000 years ago. Let us dare to assume our responsibility, Bolivia's responsibility, before the world, before our history and our society. Knowledge of nuclear energy is knowledge of the ABCs of nature. Bolivia has the technical, scientific, and moral obligation to take responsibility for the knowledge, use, understanding, and beneficial development of this fundamental force of nature. It doesn't matter how long it takes us. We are going to do it because we are convinced that that is how we cement the conditions for the technological development of Bolivians for the next 400 to 500 years.
Wow.
That's Promethean thinking.
Right. And for our listeners, we're going to ask you to spread the news of this discussion, Dean Andromedis, Gretchen Small, on the LaRouche Show to other citizens in the United States, and do it quickly. Look, what's being described is the most exciting thing. To me, it's the fulfillment of what Franklin Roosevelt told Winston Churchill at the end of World War II. Winston, you know, after this war, we're not going back to your 18th century or 17th century gunboat diplomacy. And then FDR unfortunately died before, and Truman turned the United States into a British puppet. And we have the worst British puppet of all times with Obama. But we're back to that opportunity, and the LaRouche movement, Executive Intelligence Review, which is our articles are published in 7-8 different languages, www.larouchepub.com. Click on international. It's all over the world. We are the institution that brings the United States into this process. Dean, we have a minute. You're our guest from a long, far away. Why don't you have the final word?
The final word. Well, I think if you take into consideration what Gretchen just said and what we discussed earlier, these are very exciting times. And it is a renaissance. And we're fulfilling a mission that not only have we have, as an organization, have been fighting for the better part of 40 years, but so many others have. And if you look at the nuclear industry, in the 1950s, people like Louis Strauss and others, I mean, around the world, saw this as not only cheap electricity for the United States or Europe, but the most far-reaching ones saw that this is the way we can rapidly develop Africa, Latin America, and Asia with cheap, unlimited energy. And now we are literally back to that way of thinking.
Okay, we're out of time. Let me just end again with the title of Helga Zeplerush's speech at the conference in China this past week. She said, "The Silk Road in the 21st century is the cornerstone of peace and order." Thank you guys for joining us.
Sure.